supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Through his technique of reading micro-expressions, Dr. Paul Ekman proved that the look on your face can say more than you think, maybe even more than you know. His work serves as the inspiration for the hit Fox television show Lie to Me. It's also inspired the Dalai Lama to contribute to his research, as well as join him in writing a book called Emotional Awareness, an important breakthrough in modern science. Dr. Ekman's work earned him the honor of being named by the American Psychological Association as one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century. So, in what ways can we personalize this science to better understand ourselves as well as those around us? Joining me today is one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, Dr. Paul Ekman. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. So you developed a research tool called the Facial Action Coding System for deciphering which of the 43 muscles in our faces are working at any given moment.
That's true. I was actually published 31 years ago and is the standard tool used by most scientists who are studying facial expression.
Is it safe to call this the biology of the unconscious?
No, I wouldn't say that because we're often, we use our face for many different things. There are a lot of different facial movements. We wink, for example. We put on social smiles. We do a lot of things that we're quite conscious of. But there are a set of involuntary emotional expressions. And some people are quite aware of the look that's on their face. In fact, I'm sure all of your listeners have had the experience where someone says to them, "What's upsetting you?" And it's because they've seen on your face the sign of an emotion that you were not yet aware of feeling, even though you had begun to act in a quite emotional way. So the face is a multi-signal system. It shows conscious, deliberate. It shows unconscious, involuntary.
Your work, I know, in part was inspired by Darwin, who believed in the universality of emotions. And essentially, your work proved that it is so with basic emotions across cultures. But to get there, you had to begin somewhere. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it actually wasn't my idea to study this issue. It was a grant manager who was having difficulties with his wife from Thailand, and he thought maybe there was some cultural misunderstanding of her gestures and expressions, and he asked me if I'd like to have some money to try to find out what they were. Amazing. It just fell right into my lap. This was 43 years ago, 1966, and at that point, the dominant view in most of the Western world, was Margaret Mead's view that anything the face shows is written by culture and that facial expressions are as much a language as our words are, so that a smile could mean you're angry in another culture and sadness could, what we think of as sadness, where the lip corners are down, could mean you're happy. Now, Darwin, 1872, best-selling book, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, his view is exactly the opposite, that this was not only universal to our species, binding all people together, but was shared with other animals. This, of course, fit his theory of natural selection. And this is the 200th birthday of for Darwin, the year 2009. So I set out to try to resolve this question, and the decisive study was to go to a Stone Age culture that had never had contact with the outside world. So they showed the same expressions as we do. You couldn't attribute it to watching the media, meeting outsiders or looking at photographs or magazines. Well, that was 67 and 68 that I was in that New Guinea pre-literate culture.
Well, you even gone further. I mean, there is some evidence now with animals are showing what I would label compassion, kind of responsiveness to other animals in distress.
Yes, that's very true. There's this one amazing experiment where you set animals, monkeys actually, in two adjacent cages where they can see each other, and for one of them to get food, the other one gets a shock. Every time you press the lever that gives you something to eat, it hurts the other monkey. And monkeys have gone for days not eating in order not to hurt another monkey. But the kicker is, that's so if they know the monkey that would get hurt. They'll go for hours, maybe a day or two, if it's a strange monkey. Not as much compassion for the stranger as for the familiar or the family member. And that's the same in humans as well.
Incredible study. I've got, Paul, I've got a grandson who's on the autism spectrum. And he said something early on after he started speaking. He was swinging on a swing set in the backyard, and he was going a little bit too high for his mother, and his mother had some anxiety, and she made an expression. And Sam said, "Mommy, I don't know that face." So given what you've learned, could you teach Sam and all the Sams in the world on the spectrum to read expressions and to be responsive to them? Could you bring them up to our cultural baseline?
Well, that's an important question for which I don't have a conclusive answer, but a tentative one. For a very different purpose, for trying to aid doctors, nurses, police, and anti-terror people, I developed a tool called MET, which stands for the Micro-Expression Training Tool, and it's online. Anybody can learn it. It turns out that it teaches you how to recognize signs of concealed emotion, but in the process, it really goes over what each emotion looks like and how not to confuse anger with disgust or fear with surprise. Well, an English scientist tried this with schizophrenic patients. That's not who I intended it for, but she found that in 40 minutes of training, the schizophrenic patients became as accurate as normal individuals. And now there are a number of people trying it with Asperger's and autism. The results aren't in yet, but I bet that it's going to have some benefit. Now, that's only the first step. The first step is to know how someone is feeling. If you don't know that, you'll never get to first base. But to get the home run, you need to then know, if I sense you're angry, how should I respond? What's the trigger for your anger? Are you angry at me? Are you angry at yourself? Are you angry at a third person? That's a different skill. And we don't know whether autistic individuals are lacking that skill because they haven't had the ability to recognize what the emotion is, so they've never really been tested to see whether, if they knew what the emotion was, would they know what to do about it, what's appropriate. But, there are dozens of people using my MET right now with autistic and Asperger's as well as schizophrenics to try to improve their ability to spot emotion.
That's really interesting. We're talking with psychologist Paul Ekman about emotions and how they show themselves on our face with micro expressions. Our number is 888-477-9499. Can you tell what someone else is feeling, or has anyone ever told you what you were feeling before you were aware of it? Again, the number is 888-477-9499. Paul, 26 years ago at a NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health Conference, you suggested the existence of emotional profiles. Tell us what these are and to what extent do they define us?
Well, you know, we all have the same emotions, but we don't become emotional about exactly the same things. You know, the interference with our pursuit of a goal is frustrating and will, in most people, bring forth anger. But what that goal is and how angry we get and how quickly we become angry and how long we stay angry and how long it takes us to recover and get back to where we were before that frustration, that's our emotional profile. Four primary characteristics: the speed of response, do you have a slow fuse or are you explosive? The strength of your response, my moderate anger is another person's most intense anger. We really differ on the strength of these emotional responses. And how long do you stay in a angry or fearful or sad? Does it take a long time for it to begin to ebb? Or is it going to be over in a few seconds? And then how long does it take you to recover? That's what I call the emotional profile. And shortly, I'll have a tool on the Internet that people can use to discover their own emotional profile and the emotional profile of someone that they're intimately involved with. So, because that can be a source of conflict, the unknown differences in how we are interacting emotionally.
Well, and known differences can help diminish conflict, too.
But at least they can allow us to know what it is that's causing the trouble.
Right, right. So, Paul, here we have a research psychologist talking to a clinical psychologist. So, you know, the next question I have to ask is, you know, our emotional profile. It sounds, one could argue that you're talking about a neurological phenomenon. Are they fixed? Can they change? How can they be changed?
It's another great question that we don't know the answer to. It's my bet is that the answer is going to be like the answer is to most questions about how individuals differ, that some individuals have more flexibility and more potential for change than others. And so, yes, I would bet that the emotional profile can be modified relatively easily for some and nearly impossible for others. Now, I think of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as an example of a modification of the emotional profile where it becomes a very fast, intense response that's very difficult to manage as a result of overwhelming repeated trauma. That's a change in a negative direction. Most of us would like to have a more gradual emergence of emotion and a more moderate emotional response. But that's not what some of us seem to be born with.
Well,
modifiable? Probably. For everyone? Probably not.
That makes sense. I want to tell you a personal experience. You know, I had a car accident that left me disabled. I had some PTSD, mild to moderate, and of course I was hypervigilant. My response time was faster. But over the years, I have faced death several times and, you know, always feel it around the corner. And that knowledge, that kind of existential presence, has really slowed down my response time.
Well, of course, we have a contaminant. This is the nature of life. You're also older. How much of what you're talking about is the natural result of aging? We did research 20 years ago that showed that the strength of the autonomic nervous system, the system that governs on our bodily responses like respiration and heart rate, those get weaker with age, so that a 60-year-old does not have as strong a response as a 40-year-old or 20-year-old. So it's always an issue. How much of it is our social experience? How much of it is the techniques we've used to try to gain emotional awareness? And how much is just the normal aging process?
Yeah, so I guess that's why many of us old cockers get accused of being wise. It's just, it's nothing special. It's just systems slowing down.
Well, I think if it's going to be wisdom, you've got to have some understanding as well. Understanding that you can use not only yourself, but can convey to others that they can benefit from. Mm. And the chief issue in emotional regulation, in being able to make the decision, do I want to engage emotionally, or is that trivial? And or did I might perhaps misunderstand what was going on? And if I do engage, how? You can't make those decisions. You don't have any choice unless you're aware of the emotions that are beginning to stir within you. You know, I started out as a clinical psychologist, and my last psychotherapy supervisor said to me, if you can increase the gap between impulse and aware and action, if you can make your patients aware of the impulses before they act, you'll have been of enormous benefit.
Well, all of that tells me that, that first of all, your most recent supervisor was not a psychoanalyst. And the other thing it tells me is it's time to talk about your relationship with the Dalai Lama, and you're getting steeped in Buddhism, which is you're bringing us right in that neighborhood. We've got to take a 60-second break, Paul, and we'll be back with calls. We'll be back to talk about how your work integrates with Buddhism and vice versa. We're talking with psychologist Paul Ekman. He's been described as one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century by the American Psychological Association. He's a professor of psychology at the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA Medical School in San Francisco. And he's published several books. In his most recent, Emotional Awareness, he's also published Telling Lies and Emotions Revealed. The hit Fox TV show Lie to Me is also based on his work. If you want to join our conversation and tell us about emotional regulation, perhaps something about your emotional profile, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Greg, when you take three or four musicians who've all been stars in different bands and put them together, you have another group that's even bigger, right?
Not necessarily, Jim.
Well, it's all right. Riding around in the breeze. Well,
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Today on Sound Opinions, we take a look at rock's best and worst supergroups.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The new novel, A Happy Marriage, follows a husband tending to his wife as she succumbs to bladder cancer. On the next Fresh Air, author Rafael Iglesias talks about writing this fictional, yet autobiographical, telling of his marriage to Margaret and her death in 2004. The New York Times called Iglesias' book the novel of his life. Join us.
Today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Dr. Paul Ekman. He's a research psychologist, professor of psychology, the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA Medical School in San Francisco, named one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century. Paul, when I read your biography, it starts with the death of your mother from suicide.
Yes.
When you were 14 years old. You later learned that she had bipolar disorder, and you've said that this is the beginning of your career in psychology. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your life before her death?
Well, it was rather confusing. I was actually spending a lot of my time not recognizing the tragedy that was unfolding in front of me. It was more than I could deal with or comprehend. And, you know, the child is very dependent on the parents, particularly in those days on the mother. And yet, by the time you move into adolescence, you start to assert your independence, your wish for freedom from parental supervision. So to have imposed upon that the unfolding of a severe mental illness was very problematic, and really, my career, certainly the choice to go into psychology to learn the skills that would be necessary so that in the future I could help such people. And my first studies after I got my PhD were with depressed women, and with trying to be able to identify suicidal intent.
Paul, I'm blocking on the developmental psychologist's name who developed a theory of a developing psyche, but he likened it to a bubble in water. And if the outside pressure was too much or too little, then that psyche didn't develop well. It just focused on the external environment, trying to stabilize the external environment, and never got to focus on itself and develop well. And that's the case with most any child I've met who's grown up in a difficult, unstable environment. They tend to look to the outside to try to stabilize the environment so they can feel safe.
Well, you know, I was reading the autobiography of Amos Oz, an Israeli novelist, and he had exactly the same experience at the same age. That is, mother committed suicide at 14. And to me, it was startling that so many of the thoughts he reported feeling on thinking after his mother's death were exactly the same that I had.
How so?
Blaming yourself, the belief that if you had not been so selfish, you could have prevented this. I mean, adolescents tend to be a little grandiose.
Right.
I mean, I'm not sure anyone could have prevented it at that point in time. We now know a lot more about bipolar and have multiple means of dealing with it. But it's its own rather unique. I think the sudden death of anyone you're attached to, let alone by their own hand, let alone a parent, let alone during adolescence where the issue of independence is so critical, does have a marked impact, and it seems a similar impact, at least in terms of the ideation and that goes through in the attempts to repair such a situation.
Hmm. I'd like to talk a bit about the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
You first met him in India. What was your reaction when you first saw his face?
Well, you know, his face didn't strike me. People think I'm going to see something really unusual in his face. The Dalai Lama is an extraordinary person. I've spent probably more time in one-to-one discussion than anyone, at least in recent years. We spent 40 hours in total in intense discussion of emotion and compassion. But when I first met him, I had the feeling, as did he later told me, and he actually wrote about it, that I had known him all my life. You know, everyone's had a deja vu experience. You meet a total stranger, and you feel like this isn't the first time. You really feel a strong connection. I felt he was the brother I never had. Now, the Dalai Lama, of course, can explain this. He believes that we were brothers in a previous incarnation, and he's very amused by the fact that I, the Western scientist, having the same experience, can't explain it. Because Western science has no explanation for deja vu at all. But we got along so intensely and developed such a strong connection that we decided a few years later to pursue these discussions, and that resulted in a book. Now, I should make clear, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm really not an adherent of any religion. I admire the ethical commitments that you find embedded in all the major religions, but I just do not believe in an afterlife, whether it's heaven and hell or reincarnation. It doesn't fit for me.
Do you?
No way. He says to me, how do I know whether it's true? I can't know. It's just what I believe. And I have to say the same about my lack of belief. I don't know whether I'm right. I just know it doesn't fit me. But the Buddhists have developed much more focus on mental exercises. We have all of these exercises for the muscles and gymnasiums for the muscles, but we haven't paid as much attention to how to cultivate attention, particularly internal attention. And they have some things that I think are very useful and can be exported into Western approaches.
Speaking of that, and I want to ask you one more question before we get to the callers. I've been giving out numbers for the whole show and I've been hugging you for myself. But you asked the Dalai Lama a wonderful question. You said, why in the world should breathing in and out through your nose every day help you manage your emotions? It does sound silly on the surface, doesn't it?
Yes, and you know, from his vantage point, that was a silly question.
Yeah, of course.
Who cares why? If it works, use it.
Oh,
you
boy,
see, that's what
that
the Buddha said. The Buddha said, this is what works for me. Try it out. If it works for you, use it. If it doesn't, reject it. There's no... One of the things I do like about Buddhism is that there's no dogma. Although a lot of Western Buddhist teachers talk as if it is a dogma, it isn't. It's just a set of practices that you can try on, and if they're useful, you adopt them, and if they're not, discard them. But to me, as a scientist, if this benefits emotional life, I have to try to understand why. What's going on in the brain? What's changing in our psychology that can make us more aware of our own feelings? Not afterwards, but at the moment we're having them.
Do you meditate?
Sometimes. I meditate when I'm in... Either I am sort of like trapped in an airplane without a book to read, or when I'm agitated. Actually, what I do, rather than meditate very often, is I listen to a CD that I've made that has part of our actual dialogue. Yeah. And just listening to that calms my mind and brings me back to a state of equilibrium. Huh. But I occasionally meditate, not regularly.
Let's go to calls. We've got Suzanne on the line. Suzanne?
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. How can we help you?
Well, I would like to know, I'm blind, and I've been blind all my life, and I'm very curious about this understanding of facial expressions, and as a blind person, I think I get a lot of information through people's voices, but I've often wondered whether or not I miss anything, and I'm also often have wondered whether or not my facial expressions yield the same kind of information as people, those of people who can see.
Well, those are a very good questions, Suzanne.
We could probably do a series of shows on those.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah, there have been a number of studies comparing congenitally blind with sighted individuals. We have a dual emotional system. We have the face, which is always there, and the voice, which actually most of us learn to suppress. Babies cry. Adolescents and adults don't cry very much. But there is a sound, a change in the vocal apparatus, and so emotions are very recognizable from the voice. And so there's no question that when someone speaks, you're getting the information. Now, the problem, of course, is how is that other person feeling when they're not speaking? That you can only get if you're looking at their face. In terms of your own expressions...
Can I interrupt you there
sure,
for a second,
right
Paul? Because in my office, I often will hear a tone in a voice that doesn't match the words. And I'll bring that up. I mean, that leaves me confused. So I'll bring that up, and that often leads to a fruitful discussion. Now, I don't know what the emotion is, but I know there's something going on in there that's not getting verbalized.
Yes, well, of course, it is the discrepancy between the voice and the speech, or the face and the speech, or the voice and the face that really reveals to us, the observer, that there's more going on than the person either wants us to know or doesn't know at all. Take these micro-expressions, which I mentioned earlier. These are these very fast signs of concealed emotion, but those can occur with suppression, where the person is deliberately concealing, or with repression, where the person is totally unaware of how they're feeling. But just one more thing on the your caller. The studies do show that the facial expressions of blind and sighted individuals are really no different. That was one of the important elements in showing that there's a biological basis to expressions of emotion. However, whether that persists in later childhood, adolescent, and adulthood depends on how much social interaction the person has. In the past, blind individuals did not have as much social interaction with other individuals as sighted individuals. But if you are, as you sound, a sociable, engaging person, then you're probably having as rich a social life as anyone else. You're getting most of the information you need from the voice, and you should be showing the same expressions as anyone else, and other people are reading your face as they read the face of anyone else.
Suzanne, thanks so much for your call. Suzanne's question kind of leads to another one. You began studying Buddhist monks in your labs, and it gave you some insight into how emotions get translated. I'm curious about that feedback mechanism between what we express facially and the kind of feedback we get.
Well, it's not too good from the face. You know, we have exquisite sensitivity for changes in temperature. When our nose gets cold, we can feel it immediately. We have exquisite sensitivity for pressure, for touch on our face. But we don't, most of the time, we're unaware of the expressions that are showing on our face. The muscle movements, unless it's frozen on the face, are rarely registered in consciousness. And that's why this breath exercise, which teaches you to become aware of an automatic process. I mean, you don't need to think about breathing. If you did, we'd never be able to go to sleep. You breathe automatically, but by focusing on your breath, you develop new neural circuits that register in awareness automatic processes, and that has transfer to what's going on in your emotions, which are also set off rather automatically.
Well, I personally, I think it does even more than that, and my experience is that when one sits there for a half hour or so and attends to the breath, emotions and thoughts, of course, come up and come up pretty frequently. And one of the learnings on a conscious level and I believe on a neurological level is you can have an intense emotion and you don't need to do anything about it.
Yes,
it just
I
comes
really and, agree with you.
And it goes, and that's a critical piece of learning.
Yes, you can experience it and let it go like a cloud goes across the sky. Look at it and you don't connect or stay with it.
I had a woman come to me years ago when I was teaching, and she was a beautiful woman, had been a model, was working on her doctorate now, and she came up to me, and here I am at the time, I was a 50-year-old quadriplegic, and she said, you know, I can identify with you, and I, you know, right, you know, it was a beautiful 28-year-old woman. So I said, how? And she says, well, She said, people look at you and they see a wheelchair. She said, they look at me and they just see a face, a mask. Neither one, you know, people don't relate to who we are. They just relate to the shell on the outside. We had a caller earlier on who just mentioned that what happens to these attractive women who'd get a whole different kind of feedback from the society that's not necessarily genuine.
Yes, it's that's very makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, let's take a brief break, and we're gonna come back and talk with Dr. Paul Ekman. The Fox TV show Lie to Me is based on his work, and he's spent many hours with the Dalai Lama. They have co-authored a terrific book called Emotional Awareness. He's also written Telling Lies and Emotions Revealed. His work has been used by intelligence agencies all over the world, including the CIA. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm going to make it to be 100, maybe 102. At 101, I'll stop dieting and eat everything I need to under the sun.
If you're over 50 and have embraced a new passion or direction in life, we want to hear your story. Stories of encore careers, new experiences, or creative civic involvement. Be a part of WHYY's Coming of Age series. Visit us at whyy.org/wider horizons.
Tell Me More summer reading series continues with a look at Alexander Himon's latest book of short stories. They hopscotch from Kinshasa to Sarajevo to Chicago. It's not a memoir, but
I expand myself into the text. In some ways, I'm everyone in my stories.
A look into the pages of love and obstacles. That's next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Dr. Paul Ekman, professor of psychology at the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA Medical School in San Francisco, named one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century by the American Psychological Association, based in large part on his groundbreaking research on human emotions. Paul, let's go right to the phones. We'll speak with Carolyn first. Carolyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling with a question. I had read something a long time ago about an FBI profiler, and they said that one of the indicators of either consciously or non-consciously saying something that was either a lie or you didn't fully believe was touching your face, and more specifically, touching around your nose area. Is that something that you've studied?
I have. Carolyn, and it does not work. I mean, there are part of the problem that occurs in this field of lie detection about serious lies is if you have one or two experiences where it works, you think, I've got it, and it works for everyone. It works for very few people. Touching the nose, which actually was in the very first episode of this TV program, Lie to Me, despite my objections. Anybody who watches that program should go to foxtv.com, and there's a column every week of mine called The Truth About Lie to Me, separates the science from the fiction. So touching the nose can be, for many, many reasons, having nothing to do with lying. Occasionally it might, but so can touching the ear or touching your knee or touching your elbow. It's one of the many fictions that floats around, and don't take it seriously.
Thanks so much for your call, Carolyn. Paul, before we run out of time, I'd like to get to the show Lie to Me and delve into it a little bit more. As I said, it's a fictional show based on you and your work. Movie star Tim Roth plays you, and your group consulted to solve crimes. Let's listen to a clip.
I still don't understand what we're doing, investigating these suicides.
Our two sisters jump off the same bridge within the same week.
I think that's
You're gonna find out why. There, see that?
Eyes down and away. That's shame.
There is again.
Yeah, shame on the other sister too.
Exactly the same expression. You know, agony is what we normally see in suicide victims. Shame is something else.
Paul, true?
Some of it's true. You know, when they first came to me about this program, although I liked the executive producer and I thought he was really a good writer, I thought the hazards were too great. But they told me they're going to do this with or without me, and they were going to base it on my work, whether I cooperated or not. So I really had no choice. And by cooperating and getting involved with the show, I get to review every script multiple times and at least tell them when they're putting something on that's totally implausible. Now, the most implausible thing is that Tim Roth, Dr. Lightman, solves everything within an hour. Of course, it's a TV program. He has to. I never solve anything within an hour. And he's always absolutely certain, and I'm rarely absolutely.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that they portray him as kind of an arrogant, a bit narcissistic. So,
well,
I mean,
there was a
you
part
see,
of our
you
contract
seem...
said that he could resemble me personally in no way. He had to have a different personality, a different nationality. He had to be divorced, not married. He had to have a problematic relationship rather than a good one with his child. I didn't think they'd go as extreme as they've gone. I mean, people do like it. It is a hit in many countries at this point. But Roth is plays a very edgy, arrogant, overly confident fellow, but that's entertainment.
So what you're telling us about yourself is that you're a hell of a nice guy.
Well, at least I'm not like Tim Roth. Nobody who knows me gets confused. Actually, Tim Roth, as I've gotten to know him personally, is a very nice guy. But this is the role that they decided they wanted him to play.
That's clear.
And he's getting softer. I mean, by the end of the 13 programs, which will be in another couple of weeks, and then the new season begins the end of September, he's gotten a little nicer. And that was their intent, dramatically.
On this show, there's a distinction between those who study facial expressions and come to it kind of academically and those who have good instincts. Is that distinction a real one?
Yes, it is. We have, now it's very rare. We've identified, editorial, the lead investigator is a colleague of mine who's taken over this project, Professor Maureen O'Sullivan, and we've identified about 100 people out of 15,000 that we've tested who naturally have the ability, without any special training, to be able to detect lies and distinguish it from truthfulness. And what we're trying to find out is, why did they get it? Is this a gift like being a great concert violinist, or is this something that's related to their early life or later life experience? The answer to that is not yet in. But, you know, there is this one character. The only way they portrayed her incorrectly, Torres, the Hispanic woman on the show, is they say that she's uneducated. Our natural lie detectors are all quite, you know, they have at least bachelor's degree. Many of them have more advanced degrees. But advanced degrees does not make you a good lie catcher. Again, it's less than 1% of those that we've tested.
Well, my goodness. I mean, you're a psychologist. You know that a doctorate does not make for a good psychologist.
No, that's for certain.
I want to come back to the Dalai Lama. You and the Dalai Lama disagreed about something, and he felt that compassion was an emotion, and you did not. How come? What's the difference?
Well, actually, I've changed. I'm going to be meeting with him again at the end of September, and I've thought a great deal more about this, and I now classify familial compassion, that involuntary response where you sacrifice yourself for your child without thought about it, or your less often, but sometimes towards your spouse. I do believe that's an emotion without a signal. But there are other emotions that don't have a signal. Envy doesn't have a signal. Shame and guilt look just like sadness. So it is, though, the compassion that extends beyond the family, the compassion towards total strangers, the response that some people had towards people who were suffering in Katrina or in the tsunami. A more global compassion is not an emotion because it's not there in everyone. It's by no means, unfortunately, universal.
So what's the difference between a mood and an emotion?
You know, the Dalai Lama thought that was the most useful thing I explained to him. We usually know what triggered an emotion, at least afterwards. We rarely know why we woke up on the wrong side of the bed. That's one difference. And often moods are caused by internal neurochemical or hormonal changes. The second is, and the most obvious, is that when you're in a mood, it lasts for a long time. Emotions can come and go in a matter of seconds or minutes. Moods last hours, sometimes an entire day, and moods distort our perception of the world. So when you're in an irritable mood, you're looking for a chance to get angry. When you're in an apprehensive mood, you're ready to become terrified. So they bias our responses. They last a long time, and we usually don't know why in the world we had them.
I would think that mood would be formed by emotion? There's got to be a relationship between the two.
Well, an emotional overload, and by that I mean a series of very intense emotional episodes that are very strong in a short period of time, seem to have as a consequence a related mood. There is a mood related, you know, irritability for anger, apprehensiveness for fear, melancholia for sadness, euphoria for enjoyment. So each emotion has a related mood, and they can be brought about by these very dense, intense emotional experiences, but they are often brought about by things that had nothing to do with our actual experience.
Interesting.
Just internal changes.
Interesting. Paul, the world knows about our controversy with waterboarding and torture. Is someone under extraordinary duress less likely to lie? And are these interrogators trained in knowing that?
Well, I have not had as much opportunity. I've only had one chance to train military interrogators. Although the guys who got the training liked it, the people who run the training didn't. Because I'm very strongly opposed to the use of strong psychological pressure, let alone physical torture.
Are you opposed to it ethically, or are you opposed to it because it doesn't get the outcome we want, or both?
Well, I'm certainly opposed to it ethically. In terms of outcome, you can't do a controlled experiment where you randomly assign people to torture and non-torture and then look at the outcome. So all we have is the reports, and we have reports from both interrogators and the victims of it being useful and it being useless. And so I think we have to make our decisions not on the basis of science, but on the basis of what are the traditions that we're trying to uphold in this country. There's no data, definitive data, and there can't be.
I want to come back to the cognitive issues. For someone under duress who is telling an interrogator something, could you tell from micro expressions whether they're being truthful or not?
Well, I'll only tell what emotions they're having, and I'll also be able to tell if they're trying to conceal them. But that is only relevant to trying to establish cooperation or rapport or probe further. It's not, we don't have a Pinocchio's nose. Even under torture, one doesn't emerge. So there's no absolutely certain surefire sign in demeanor of lying. They're only signs of what I call hot spots, places where you need to inquire further to find out what's not being revealed and why. But there are many reasons. I was told a couple of years ago that half of the prisoners at Guantanamo had yet to say one word. So I'm sure it's a very frustrating situation for those who try to interrogate them, and I'm sure there's been a lot of pressure. I'll tell you one of the things that really upsets me, and it's that we go after not the people who gave the orders. They're protected. Those were not the people who've gotten prosecuted for the abuses at Abu Ghraib. It's the people at the bottom of the food chain. It's the enlisted men and women, some of whom engaged in this activity, not the people higher up who encouraged them. That's totally irresponsible. We should not punish the people at the bottom for the following orders that they were given by people at the top.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. We would hope that we would have learned that lesson over the course of our history and many other countries' history, but you know, like most humans, it's hard to learn new things. Paul, unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd love to spend more time with you.
I've had a lovely time talking to you. You ask all the questions I like to be asked, and some of them that I haven't heard before.
Well, that's great. It was a great pleasure for me, too. So maybe we'll have you back one day.
I hope that happens.
And I wish you the very best, Paul.
Same to you. Thank you.
My guest today has been Paul Ekman, professor of psychology at UCLA Medical School in San Francisco, named one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century by the American Psychological Association. He's authored 15 books, including the most recent one with the Dalai Lama called Emotional Awareness. You can find more about him at paulekman.com or his work with the Dalai Lama at emotionalawareness.net. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking with psychologist author Mary Pfeiffer about her book about trying to become or winding up being the world's worst Buddhist. Join me tomorrow on my web chat, philly.com/askdan, about marriage, how to fix what's broken, and to know when it's time to end. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our interns, Jonathan Glick. Una Kwan is our volunteer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You have been in.